everybody, welcome to the Escapist Movie Podcast. We appreciate that you're here. And, you know, because it's a live podcast, some of that liveness means that you're going to see us fucking around at the start of it, which is that's just a thing that happens. Because we're live, and that's the magic of being live, is what I'm going to tell myself to make up for the fact that I am terribly, terribly unprepared today. But in any case, coming to America,
Raya and the Last Dragon.
I watched it last night, Darren. I don't remember things.
No worries.
Raya and the Last Dragon. What do you want to start with? Maybe coming to America? Which will we have less more to say about, right?
I think it's really best to start with Coming to America, because that at least is on Amazon Prime. So if you have a subscription for Amazon Prime, you can watch that free. Or we can assume people have watched that free.
Yes.
As opposed to Raya and the Last Dragon, which is a premium title, which means even if you have your $8 a month Disney Plus subscription, you have to fork out $30 for it on top of it.
Correct.
So I imagine Coming to America is probably the more democratic choice.
I like it. Let's start with Coming to America, another long waited for sequel of a classic movie that, because I love Coming to America so much, I will excuse how objectively bad it is.
That like not Coming to America, the original one, Coming. How do we differentiate between the two when we talk about them? Because they've just replaced the two with a two. So the original or the sequel?
I love the original so much. That was a constant repeat in my house growing up. I watched it. I watched Coming to America, the original, and Trading Places back to back ad nauseum. Loved it, loved it, loved it. Coming to, I guess we'll have to like put our fingers
every
up.
Every time.
And we'll have to,
if you're
like,
listening to this in audio, it's going to be a problem.
Well, I think we just have to be real dickheads and be like, Coming to America. You know, like really emphasize that too. And so Coming to America, drills up all that nostalgia for me. I laugh at all of the references to the original, though I believe it is objectively a very bad movie.
Yeah, the thing about Coming to America, or Coming to the sequel movie, as opposed to the original movie, is like, again, this is one of those weird things where I was never really a huge fan of those kind of like big 80s comedies that absolutely everybody of my generation or slightly a generation above absolutely loved. Like, again, I love Ghostbusters, but I don't think it's one of the best movies ever made, for example. Trading Places, I like, but I don't think it's one of the greatest movies ever made. And like Coming to America, I think has a lot of really interesting stuff going on, but I also don't necessarily think it's one of the greatest movies ever made. And I was it's really odd because like people talk about Eddie Murphy as one of the defining American comedians, and particularly comedian movie stars, and like entirely fairly, like absolutely fairly. Like there's no way that Darren can come in here with a hot take and say, but actually, is he really? No, he is. It's an indisputable fact.
Yes.
What I've always found, like, personally connecting with Murphy as a stage performer, as a screen performer, what I've always liked about him is the movies where it's more like you take a regular movie and you just let Eddie Murphy kind of loose on it. Things like, say, Beverly Hills Cop, which was famously, it was a Sylvester Stallone vehicle. And then it was just like, can we just drop Eddie Murphy into this? It's like, yes, you can, but you'll end up with a very different movie than the one that you intended or expected
to get. And a far superior movie, absolutely.
Yes, a much more superior. Or like the 48-hour movies with kind of Walter Hill, where it's like, the wonderful, like the like peanut butter and jelly combination of like Nick Nolte and, you know, sort of like Eddie Murphy and the two yin and yang thing you have going with them, which is massively underrated and underappreciated as far as those kind of like buddy comedy movies go. I never really kind of connected with that kind of like classic 80s like Eddie Murphy, the Trading Places, you know, the Coming to America. What is it about those movies that kind of grabbed you? What is, like, as somebody who I consider like an expert in the history of comedy, like, what is it about those movies? Where do they fall?
The interesting thing for me, like, you know, speaking specifically of, you know, like, earphone popping out. Speaking specifically of things like Coming to America and Trading Places, was like for Coming to America, the original was the characters. You know, obviously Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall play several different characters, and it was that like big bold style of comedy that you didn't see a lot in like standard comedies. You know, you saw like little bits of here and there in like your Airplanes or your Naked Gun movies. But like the way that their comedy was so brash, if that makes any sense. Like, you know, just big, loud characters swinging hard for the jokes. The original sexual chocolate in Coming to America. Like, just like, we're going to have a sequence where there's a terrible band and a terrible singer, and he drops the mic and just screams the band name. Like, oh, that's a big, bold character choice, and I really enjoy that.
And I think what I find interesting going back, because I rewatched, because, you know, I'm a professional, I rewatched Coming to America, the original, as well as Coming to America, the sequel.
Yes.
And what I found really interesting about the original is that, you know, first of all, it is, I believe, ground zero for that Eddie Murphy plays a bunch of characters under makeup trope that, you know, perhaps didn't develop organically or in an entirely healthy direction afterwards. But it's like, that's the movie where Eddie Murphy was like, I can headline this movie and I can also do a bunch of quirky, funny side stuff on there. And I think that, that was what's really interesting to me about kind of coming to the original Coming to America is that, like, you have Murphy at the top of his game, one of the biggest box office draws on the planet, one of the biggest comedians on the planet. And you watch the original Coming to America and, you know, Murphy gets a story credit. And maybe we can talk about how ridiculously mangled the behind the scenes story of the original Coming to America is. But Murphy did get a story credit, and he's like, he's come out and he said that, like, Coming to America, the original one, was a story, a weirdly personal story for him, because he found that when he got really super famous, it was impossible for him to date women who did not want to date him simply because he was absurdly wealthy and famous and weren't capable of holding conversations. A lot of that is, again, autobiographical. And again, a lot of that, you know, and again, it's been suggested that one of the driving forces behind the original Coming to America were things like, say, Spike Lee calling out Murphy and saying, you know, actually, you know, you're the biggest black star in the world. Why are you not creating more opportunities for black actors? Why are you always playing a sidekick to white characters? Why are you always teamed up with Nick Nolte or Dan Aykroyd or whatever? You know, why aren't you using your clout to make a movie that is African-American? And, you know, Murphy, to his credit, seems to have done that. Like, I think it's Questlove. There was a really good retrospective on the Jerry Curl commercial from the original.
Soul Glow.
And yes. Again, if you read the retrospective, it's fantastic. But Questlove there makes a point that, like, for him, in the history of, like, black, like, pop culture, joyous pop culture in America, there are basically three big earth-shattering moments where, like, it came into the mainstream. It's like, this is a movie that belongs to black people. This is something that belongs to black people. And it's celebratory. It's not about slavery. It's not about race relations. It doesn't even draw attention to the fact that it is, like, a prestigious thing or it's important. First one is the Soul Train, the existence of Soul Train, of TV. The third one he pointed to was the arrival of Black Panther, which was just this big, seismic, joyous occasion. And he said Coming to America was actually the second such occasion. And I find it interesting that, like, in that you have Murphy playing it relatively straight. When he plays Prince Akeem, Akeem is not, like, he's not a fool. He's not, like, a broadly drawn caricature. He's not this absurd stereotype. He doesn't feel like he wandered out of, say, Murphy's performances on Saturday Night Live. And I find it interesting that you have that happening, because obviously afterwards into the 90s, you'd have Murphy trying to break into drama. You'd have him trying to play things a bit straighter, to be taken more seriously as an actor. But I find it interesting when you watch, like, going back and watching the original Coming to America, you have Murphy doing that. And then on the sidelines, you have him also going, but I don't want to give up the broad, quirky comedy. If only there were a way for me to both be the headliner in this semi-serious kind of, like, you know, semi-serious piece of work, and also do a bunch of crazy stuff on the side. If only I could figure out a way to make that happen, which I kind of love.
Well, and I think that does harken back to his Saturday Night Live days, you know, just doing big, wacky characters, doing, like, the big makeup shtick that he would do on Saturday Night Live. And to me, it works. I think, like, you kind of hit the nail on the head here, where Eddie Murphy is playing, like, Eddie Murphy is a great straight man. He is a phenomenal setup, man. And when he is in something like Beverly Hills Cop or 48 Hours, he is playing a straight character. He's playing a setup man. Like the bits happen around him, not necessarily because of him. And that's another reason why Coming to America works so great. I guess, you know, like thinking about that culturally, that could also just be another thing where it's like, maybe I didn't understand all of the references. Like, I didn't understand why Soul Glow was such a big deal, but damn if it wasn't funny. Like, you know, everyone leaving a stain on the couch when they stand up. I'm sure like that might have been very much funnier to someone who understands the reference, but the comedy beats were there, you know, as far as cross-cultural is concerned.
Yeah, I'm trying to think who it was. It was a famous NBA basketball player, and I apologize that my Irishness is showing here, but there was a famous NBA basketball player who had a Jerry curl, and like there would be shots of him playing basketball and he would be sweating so profusely that like the kind of gel or kind of like, the styling stuff would actually like splash off his head onto other players' faces. And that was apparently like the inspiration for a lot of the humor there, which I kind of adore.
That's beautiful.
But to move the conversation towards the sequel, which is because I think there's a lot to talk about with the sequel. And I mean, maybe, you know, conceptually we can talk about that some of the stuff later on, because I think one of the interesting things reading about it is like there were a bunch of ideas that were pitched to Murphy. Mm. And Murphy was like, we're not doing that. We're not doing that. I know what we're doing. And it's not that. Mm-hmm. But the way that it turned out, which is very, it's a very nostalgic movie in that like watching the sequel. The sequel arguably feels more like an 80s movie than the original does. In that, like, I was watching the original kind of like Coming to America. Yeah. And, you know, you watch comedies from that era and you're expecting them to be a little bit dated in some senses. And, you know, a tiny bit it is, but not really. It's actually aged quite well when you compare it to some of the other stuff from that time.
Sure.
But you look at something like the sequel. And the sequel immediately like doubles down on kind of weird stuff like, and again, weird stuff that you associate with bawdy 80s comedies, which isn't it hilarious when women rape men? And isn't transgenderism kind of weird? And you're like, this stuff wasn't in the original. Like this kind of like 80s comedy stuff wasn't in the original. Why are you dropping it in now? But it does that thing that a lot of comedy sequels do where it replays a lot of the same jokes and a lot of the same punchlines and borrows a lot of the same structural cues. Mm-hmm. So things like, you know, like, again, the opening of the Paramount logo, where, and again, it's a lovely shot where the Paramount kind of Paramount logo gives way to the landscape and we kind of zoom across it and come up to the palace, or, you know, little things like the kind of like starting device of, oh, isn't it hilarious how he's woken up in the morning because they're so ridiculously wealthy, or even things like the big ceremony at the start, which is done as a punchline. In the first one, it's the, by the way, meet your new wife. In the second one, it's the, we're going to stage a live funeral for your father. And what I found, and again, it's one of those things about comedy that I don't know if it works, because it always, like, for me, a large part of what makes comedy work is the unexpected punchline. So when you do that in comedy sequels, a lot of it's like, oh, I know what the punchline is because I already saw this joke 20, 30 years ago. But I also think for me, and again, I worry I'm going to be the bad guy in this section of the podcast, and I apologize for
that. You probably are, but that's okay.
Yeah, one of us has to be, right? That we've had the coin beforehand, it's fine. But for me, what really took it away, and again, this is something that comes with a lot of baggage, and we could talk about it if you want to, but you watch the original Coming to America, and I would argue that a large part of why so much of the comedy there works, particularly in the first act when they're in Zamunda, is the basically the direction of John Landis. Because Landis, you know, and again, a lot of really thorny stuff happening around there. This was after the Twilight Zone stuff. This was that Murphy, by his own account, apparently took, and again, Landis disputes this, but Murphy says, I took pity on Landis after the Twilight Zone stuff because he was never going to work again. He'd come off a number of flops and stuff. So I was like, you know, I'll give you this movie to direct for me. Because again, Murphy was at that point very much on his way upwards. Apparently it was a nightmarish experience for both of them. Murphy, in trademark tactful way, said, you know, when he was asked about the opportunity to work with Landis again, after Coming to America, he famously said, Vic Morrow has more chance of working with John Landis. Vic Morrow being one of the people who died on the Twilight Zone sequence directed by Landis.
According to Eddie Murphy was prepared to beat the shit out of John Landis on set in front of everyone, knowing that no one would stop him.
And again, like, this is the thing where, and again, like, the real punchline to that setup and joke, though, is that, like, afterwards, they both went on to make a Beverly Hills Cop 3 together. Mm. That's the real punchline to that. But, like, for all, like, the flack and all the tension that happened on the set of Coming to America, I think a lot of its success comes from Landis as a director. Because, like, you look at Landis's big films, so things like, say, Animal House, things like The Blues Brothers, you could arguably even go back to, and again, this is a separate podcast discussion we need to have at some point, that weird period in the 80s where Michael Jackson was like, I want the greatest auteurs in cinemas to direct my music videos. I get Martin Scorsese, I'm going to get Francis Ford Coppola, I'm going to get John Landis to do Thriller. But you look at those, like, those movies in Landis's filmography, Blues Brothers, Animal House, even the Thriller video, what Landis does really well as a director is he captures a sense of scale and spectacle and chaos and, like, the ability to make something laugh and funny and amusing in chaos. So think of, like, the climax of Trading Places, where it's on the floor of the stock exchange and it's pure madness. That's kind of very much a Landis kind of trope. And, like, you look at things like, say, the opening sequence of the original Coming to America, where they have the big string quartet and they have the setup and all that. Like, the attention to detail that Landis has in making that joke land, how carefully as a director he sets up everything, he moves everything into position so that when the punchline lands, it's like, this is amazing. This is like a Rube Goldberg comedy machine.
And it's just the woman walking. The punchline, of course, is the woman slowly, awkwardly walking up the aisle. Right.
But you look at things like, then you compare that to what this movie does when it's copying the joke. When it's directed by Craig Brewer, who I believe directed Dolomite Is My Name, which is on Netflix and is well worth your time if you want to check out Eddie Murphy, Wesley Snipes, Craig Brewer combo, because apparently they're now a team. But they come as part of a combo pack. But when you look at what Craig Brewer does, those gags, they didn't work as well for me. They didn't feel like as orchestrated or as careful or as meticulous in the setup. The little thing where, like, they go and they get a little triangle to wake them up. The way in which that's edited is a bit jumpy. It doesn't feel like it builds naturally. And I was kind of like, I felt a bit like the repetition of the jokes didn't always work for me.
No, I think like there's a ton of problems with Coming to America. A ton of problems. And I think, like, you can take the two opening sequences shot for shot and compare them. Like you said, it's not just the scale. It's also setting up the importance. And I think scale is a part of that. But also, like, the pomp and circumstance of royalty is, like, a huge part of that setup gag in the first movie. And here, you know, we see a couple dudes line up. We see a big box that might be important. Something mechanical comes out of the box. But we also have no idea where we are or what they're doing. And, you know, that's the three rules. Set up the who, the what, and the where. We didn't know two of those. Technically, we only knew the one. We only knew the who because of the name of the movie.
Fair point.
And so, like, the work that needs to happen to set up these jokes was not paid attention to across the movie. I agree with you. But I have that nostalgia.
that's fair.
What I've always said is you can always tell that there is, like, a percentage of a movie. The higher the percentage of a movie that is dedicated solely to song and dance sequences that is not a musical, that's how bad that movie is going to be. And while I grew up quite literally listening to En Vogue and Salt-N-Pepa, we did not need an En Vogue and Salt-N-Pepa song and dance routine in Coming to America.
But that's the 80s nostalgia. Somehow, somehow the sequel to Coming to America is more of an 80s period piece than the original is, which is remarkable.
Yes.
Like, it's like, this is very much like you remember what the 80s were like. It's like, I don't remember because I was a kid. It's like, yeah, but you think you do. And that's what this movie is.
And I see in chat here, someone is saying, could the editing be that way? Like, maybe it was shot during the pandemic and they couldn't shoot enough pickups. And no, I don't believe that was the case. They had a bunch of people in the same room together. It's about proper setup is the thing. Like, technically speaking, we see, like, we know it's a Coming to America movie. We know we're in Zamunda. We know we are in the Royal Palace, right? And the way the shot works in Coming to America is we start to see what we can only assume to be, like, royal butlers doing something important. They all gather together. They get this box. This thing comes out of the box, and it's a triangle that they then use to wake up the prince and princess, the characters from Coming to America. But because we didn't know that they were in a bedroom, because we didn't know what they were doing, we had no context for the joke setup. Really, all it really needed was it needed better music. If we could have edited that same sequence with like big important music, it needed a nice big wide shot to establish.
Yes, that, that's like, exactly what it needed.
It needed a big wide shot to see like all the servants. Maybe all the servants could like do something in synchronous where it's like, oh, okay, this is like a parade. This is pomp. We needed something like that, and they probably just didn't have the space to do it in the location they were shooting in.
That's fair. There's also, when you watch the sequence, a real sense of get to the punchline. Yes. Like, a lot of the stuff is cut. Like, they don't do, like, it's not a long take of them opening the box and taking out the triangle. They open the box and the triangle comes up, and then you cut to the guy in intense close-up holding the triangle already, as if the movie can't wait to get to the, like, it can't yes. wait to get to the bit that you recognize. And it's like, yeah, I get that. But, you know, on the other hand, like, understand why the joke worked as much as anything else. Now, to be fair, I do seem like I'm being really unfairly harsh to it. I apologize. I'm sorry. I didn't hate it. I didn't actively dislike it, to be fair. I just kind of, it didn't really kind of click with me.
No, but I mean, and it did click with me literally only because I love the original so much. Like, I felt the same way. Like, I think we talked about this when we talked about Bill and Ted Face the Music, where it's not necessarily a good movie, but if you like the originals, then you're going to like this one. I'm sure there's a million other like sequels made way after the time that we could point to here that don't work, because only one has worked, which is Fury Road. But like, you know, similarly speaking, in Coming to America, we get a similar bathtub joke. The original, of course,
yes.
is that the prince has a royal washer who, you know, does stuff to him in the bathtub. What a funny joke. Which, you know, watching this as a kid, that was hilarious, I'm sure.
Also because it was the 80s, it was a way of seeing boobs. Like, again, exactly. You know, and again, I'm wary of seeming obsessively creepy on the podcast, but, like, as a teenager, like, at the cusp of the 90s, yeah. the way that you generally saw boobs was by watching R-rated movies. And again, yeah. like, I was really taken by that. That's the big difference between the original and the sequel, is that the original is an 80s R-rated comedy. And, like, it doesn't need to be an R-rated comedy. It's, like, completely gratuitously an R-rated yes. comedy. It's like, we're worried that if it's a PG-13 movie, people won't want to see this Eddie Murphy movie. So can we stick a topless woman in that shop behind Eddie Murphy just so we get the rating? Can we have a sequence where he goes out onto a balcony and says, fuck you, New York! Just so we can like get that hard ore.
That was a good joke, though. That was, a great joke.
I love that joke. I do absolutely like. Okay, fine. Maybe it did need to be an ore. I apologize for that joke. But the sequel is a PG-13 movie through and through, isn't it?
Right. Well, and so, you know, once again, you know, in the original movie, the joke is that there is a topless woman bathing him, and obviously, yes, that is just to get the boobs in there. But also, it's showing what his life is like. It's showing how pampered he is. And, you know, it's a joke. The sequel joke is the same joke, nothing else, you know.
But like, now it's a woman.
But now, yeah, but now it's Leslie Jones, and a buff man comes up and says, I'm done scrubbing your privates. And she goes, once more, please. But it's the same joke. Yeah. And like you had mentioned earlier, like, something that makes jokes funny is juxtaposition. When we don't know what the punchline is going to be and we are caught by surprise, and we can't be caught by surprise if we see Leslie Jones in a bathtub, we know, yes, we know that there's a dude under there. We're waiting for the dude to pop up. Coming to America, much like the other made 30 years later sequels, will be forgotten about. Everyone's already forgotten about Bill and Ted Face the Music. you know?
I would argue Bill and Ted Face the Music was a better movie than this. I mean, I don't think it's a great movie. I don't think it's as good as the first two, but I think it has something to say. Like, I'm not entirely sure that the sequel, Coming to America, has anything to say beyond the fact that, like, you know, Eddie Murphy likes money. and I mean, and everybody likes the original Coming to America as well, obviously, but, you know.
No, and like they're trying, they were trying for a few things here. They touched on like an issue in Coming to America,
yeah,
about like, you know, Eddie Murphy in the first movie was ready to change the world. He was going to become king and change the way Zamunda ran itself. And as it turns out, he really hasn't. Because you know, his father, James Earl Jones, the king, was still alive, but he hasn't done anything to better Zamunda. And so, oh, what's up?
No, I was just thinking, that's the ultimate Gen X movie, isn't it? It's like you're like, you were all rearing to go out there and stick it to the system and change the world from the ground up, man.
Yeah.
Except your boomer dad is still kicking around now. And it's like, no, don't worry. I got this. You're completely incompetent and incapable of doing anything for yourself. Thank goodness I'm still here to run the show. So I did appreciate that.
Right. Well, and they were kind of touching on that, where after his father dies, after the boomer dies, it's his job to take over, and he finds himself falling back into the same patriarchal patterns that was literally like the kickoff point to the plot of the first movie. And so you go, oh, okay, well, maybe this is what it's about. But then it never digs any deeper than scratching at it. Just at the end, he goes, lesson learned, I fixed everything again, don't worry.
Well, that was one of the big things with the sequel and development of the sequel, because apparently, like, Ryan Coogler, and again, this is the kind of weird synergy between, and again, I can't believe I'm saying this, I am not an expert in African-American pop culture, I am not pretending to be, but everything that I have read suggests this connection exists. The idea of the connection between, like, Coming to America and Black Panther, where, like, Ryan Coogler, who was apparently a big fan of Coming to America, sat down with Eddie Murphy and said, I have the pitch for your sequel to Coming to America, for your belated coming. It's your son has to go to America and has to find a bride. And, you know, it turns out this time the nation's poor and she's wealthy. And that's the big reversal that we have here. Okay. And, you know, he's going to be played by Michael Jordan, basically.
Of course.
Yeah, that's Ryan Coogler. And like Eddie Murphy heard this pitch and he was like, no, we're not doing that. I don't want Michael B. Jordan in my movie. I want my movie. Thank you very much. I felt that, to be fair, he may have, as Eddie Murphy's gotten older, I imagine he's couched that kind of like ego a little better. And he may have framed it more like, I feel like it would be a betrayal to the fans if we didn't have all of the old characters in there, you know?
Well, and, you know, this is obviously no slight against Jermaine Fowler, who does a very good job in Coming to America. Which I have to say, what that sounds like to me is that Coogler's version might have been about something, and this movie wasn't. It scratches at some ideas, like there's some patriarchal generational sexism things floating around here and there, but none of the actions in the movie progress those issues brought up. It's just these are the issues we're going to talk about. Some comedy stuff happens later. We fix it at the end. No, they're not connected in any way. Yeah.
What I will say, actually, because I, you know, I've been kind of negative on this, I will say I'm very happy to see Wesley Snipes back. Like, you know, as somebody who like grew up with 90s action movies, and Simon Phoenix is, you know, one of my favorite movie characters ever. Seeing Wesley Snipes presumably being told, however you play this, there is no way for you to underplay it. Like, just go for it, go wild. I actually had a lot of fun watching Wesley Snipes kind of like parading in and being like, no. I'm only in a couple of scenes of this bad boy, but it belongs to me, just so we're clear.
And like, to me, that's why I can't be mad at Coming to America, because everyone is having a really good time. Yeah. And it's like, if you want to make a bunch of money and take a victory lap for how good Coming to America was, you have fun. I got to watch it as part of my Amazon Prime subscription service. So yeah, oh, great. You have a great time.
Yeah, it didn't cost you anything more than you were already paying for, exactly. And you enjoyed it. Like, again, you know, it's very much like a McDonald burger, not a McDonald burger. And again, another one of those great repeated jokes as well. Although I kind of like, it's one of those things where I'm not entirely sure whether the joke is like in the movie or on me as an audience member, where they do the whole like McDonald product placement kind
McDowell.
Of
mockery
thing. McDowell kind of a joke. And it's like, by the way, our official drink is Pepsi. And it's like, I feel like adding actual product placement to this. I'm not sure whether that like is a very clever metatextual, like jumping across the line, or if you just took a bunch of money from Pepsi, or both. Why does it have to be one thing?
Right. No. Oh, the Pepsi product placement and the not Meow Mix, like the cat food product. Like even lions love it. Even lions love this cat food right here, like right in the lens. It was a little gratuitous, but hey, what are you gonna do?
My other little details that I kind of love about the production of it is that apparently originally Eddie Murphy wanted Tracy Morgan to play the role of his bastard son. Although apparently he had to be convinced by Arsenio Hall that like nobody was going to buy Tracy, I'm only 7 years younger than Eddie Murphy, as the son or heir.
Yeah, I could see that though. Like, back in the day, Tracy Morgan, that would have been fun. That would have been real fun. Tracy Morgan is obviously still in the movie.
Yeah.
Still very fun in the movie. This is a weird soup because, you know, like the movie's a little bit about Eddie Murphy and him like realizing his new place in the kingdom. It's a little bit about Jermaine Fowler's character as the bastard son who's finding his place and basically replaying the first movie, but in microcosm because he falls in love with someone that he has like two scenes with.
And in comedy sequel tradition in reverse as well. So it's like, right, you know, the original movie was Eddie Murphy going from, you know, Zamunda to America. Mm. Now it's going to America to Zamunda. And it's like, yeah, this is a very, like, again, it's like almost more 80s than the original, because this is how you did a comedy sequel in the 80s or 90s. You just twisted the premise slightly and it was like, do it again.
This is not a movie I will probably ever watch again. This is probably not a movie I will ever think about again, just like if I'm going to just be a harsh critic, if I'm going to look at this movie as objective as possible, which objectivity and criticism is impossible, unless we're talking about technical aspects. I believe it is a bad movie. It is a comedy that on its own merits is not funny. That being said, if you really enjoyed Coming to America, you will watch this and smile along and be like, oh, I remember that. That's good. I remember that. That's good.
Yeah. And it does like maintain the building of the kind of shared trading places Coming to America universe, because obviously you have the weird thing with the Duke's family playing out in the background of all three movies as well. Because they take a bunch of money from him in the original Coming to America. Apparently you discover that they reinvested it apparently very wisely and now have their own, is it Duke and Duke Digital, I think is what they call it, which I quite liked as far as kind of sly jokes go.
Right. No, we get a fun little, you know, Colin Jost bit where Colin Jost is the grandson of the Dukes. Very funny. It's all very funny. And it's like that reminds me of another little thing that they scratched at, right? Where like, you know, Colin Jost is in there, Lavelle Johnson starts the movie at a job interview. Colin Jost is interviewing him and Lavelle, Jermaine Fowler's character, is kind of berating Colin Jost for everything being handed to him, for, you know, a life of ease and, you know, how dare you judge me? I've worked for that. And then it's twisted where Lavelle kind of gets handed this princehood and the rightful heir, the eldest daughter who has worked really hard to be the heir of Zamunda, is very pissed. And it's like, that's another thing that like they really scratch at that, but they don't do enough to that could have been a really interesting character thing. That could have been the structure for the comedy to hang itself around, because I guess I don't know how technical we want to be here, where it's like coming to America, the first one, much like Trading Places, isn't a comedy, much like Ghostbusters is not necessarily a comedy. It's a premise of a movie that has all of these comedic aspects to it. Yeah. You know, it's not like a slapstick fall down comedy where everything is a comedy. And maybe that's the biggest difference with Coming to America, is it doesn't have the structure to hang all the jokes on. It's over here, it's over there, it's over here, it's over there. The structure is the nostalgia, and that's the real problem.
Yeah, I mean, like, the fact that, like, you can tell the way in which the movie's structured isn't as much how the story goes, it's around the cameos, because it, like, it paces its cameos so that you know you have to keep watching, because you know there's going to be a sexual chocolate cameo. It's like, no, that one goes end, that, because we know that's the one that you're really looking forward to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at the start we get all these characters, then we get the barbershop people, because they're big, and you gotta wait a few minutes, and then we get the reverend, and then you wait a little bit longer, and we got this other cameo of, like, sexual chocolate. And, like, and I have a quick question here, actually, because again, the fact that the movie ends with a blooper reel, again, very 80s, very 90s comedy. Yes. How pissed do you think Tom and Jerry is that Coming to America, the sequel, got its John Legend post-credit stinger?
Right? Right?
And they didn't even ask for it. Like, it's not even set up in the movie. I kind of adore that.
Yes. Actually, you know what? I was watching the credits and I saw John Legend as himself. And I was like, wait a minute. John Legend wasn't in the movie. But oh, there he was.
Yeah.
That's super. I didn't even think about that. That's really hilarious. Also, where was Samuel L. Jackson? This Coming to America was a very early role in Samuel L. Jackson's career. Where was he? He's in everything.
Yeah, apparently they were supposed to shoot another sequence where he holds up. I believe he may actually travel to Zamunda again. He may travel to Zamunda to hold up the McDowells there. But they were supposed to shoot a robbery sequence with him, but they couldn't get the schedules to align, unfortunately. He does appear via flashback, though.
Oh, he does.
Archive footage.
That's right.
Actually, I didn't mind the plastic face stuff that they did at the start. You know, again, the entire, like the entire premise of the movie is very, very ropey, given that I think Semi spends most, and again, this is just because I watched the original Coming to America last night, Semi spends so much of the original Coming to America complaining that he never got laid, that it feels a bit disingenuous. That, like, the entire premise of the sequel is, by the way, Semi got laid.
Right. Well, no, I think, like, what I'm discovering as we're talking about this is what we need here, Darren, is a genre for movies like this, right? Because, like, we call an action movie because we expect action beats to happen.
Yeah.
Comedy, right? This movie's entire existence hangs on those nostalgia beats. Yeah. So what is the genre for a movie that only exists, or that is only contained within its nostalgia, is the question at hand. That's what, and I'm not saying we need to answer it now, but I feel like we need to
a term of art for it, you know, like we go up with the legacy quell or whatever. Or the,
yes, you know. This needs its own specification, because it's, as a comedy, this fails. as just a story, oh boy, like this, like it's a bad movie, but it does hang on those nostalgic moments. It's just like, we'll have to spend some time over the week and really think on what we want to call, like it's a
nostalgia quell. I don't know. Yeah.
It's a memorandum, you know, like, ooh, memory, serotonin bait.
Again, that's a South Park member berries sort of thing. It's like a member berry sort of.
No, I don't know that one.
No. Okay. Well, it's the big thing that they did, where they did all the crossover and stuff, Fantasyland and stuff. It was this big epic thing that. Okay. I don't know about South Park either. I just know that member berries have worked their way into the popular conversation.
Oh, okay.
For that sweet nostalgia hit.
Yes.
Where it's literally just like, yeah, you want that member berry. It's like, yeah, that taste is fantastic. You remember how it tasted. It's like, yeah, we don't have to. Like, it doesn't matter that this isn't as funny as the original Coming to America, because you watch it and you're reminded of how funny Coming to America was.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly what it is. It's like, yes, that Coming to America was a good movie. Thanks for reminding me, Coming to America.
Yeah. I sound like I've been very harsh on this. I did have a big smile on my face for a lot of it.
Yeah.
But I also, like, while watching it, was very much like, how does this feel more like an 80s movie than the original? And it is because, like, all it has is that tether to the 80s of the original.
Yes, that's really it. While we kind of wrap up Coming to America, before we talk about Raya and the Last Dragon. I'm just kind of looking at the, I have the IMDb page open here so I can remember everybody's names. There is a lot of people in this movie. There is a ton of people, you know, in this movie. And I think it's so fun.
Gladys Knight, salt and pepper. Trevor Noah plays the kind of like the Zamunda news anchor, which I kind of like as well, under heavy makeup. I didn't realize it was him until I checked it as well.
Oh,
and again,
yeah.
Oh, okay, fine. I'm willing to concede that. It's that kind of thing where you get a sense. And again, reading about it today, doing research for this because I'm a professional, it was like, I never realized how big this movie was. And I mean, I understand domestically it was huge. It was like the second biggest movie of the year. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's like Jason Bailey wrote an article on Vulture about it. And he said, like, the weird thing about the original Coming to America is that, like, despite being the second biggest movie of the year in which it was released, it actually acts more like we think of cult movies today, where you see people like dressed up in Zamudan kind of costume going to the Black Panther premiere. You see people quoting lines from it. It's kind of mimetic. And it's kind of like, again, it was one of those early examples of kind of like that mainstreaming before you get into the 90s, before you get to movies like The Matrix, before you get to movies like Fight Club or whatever, or The Big Lebowski, all that sort of stuff. And I find that aspect of it fascinating because I had never assumed that it was so important or so big or so vast or so
huge.
Like key and formative, like
huge for Darren me. Huge, like, and like I'm an old school comedy nerd, like, you know, so like I like before I saw that I was watching like Eddie Murphy stand up on repeat, and then, you know, his movies started coming out, and so like but Coming to America, like, we would in how old was I when the original came out?
Oh, do the maths.
However old
Matt's
I was.
Quiz, pop quiz.
Right?
88, I believe. So whatever age you were in 1988.
Right. So, like, I probably watch it on repeat in 89 or 90. So I'm, like, you know, 10, 11 years old watching this over and over again. Like, we would just, like, quote. All we would do is do the waiter joke at the end of the original Coming to America. My favorite joke of all time. Waiter, there's something wrong with my soup. Would you just waiter, would you taste the soup? That, like, that little joke that ends with him going, aha, aha. Like, that was the meme for us, was just going, aha. Oh, loved it.
And rewatching the original last night, actually, again, getting back to this kind of like John Landis as director who works well with epic scale. Mm-hmm. The really weird thing about the climax to Coming to America is that, like, it's a very intimate one where they're all in the McDowell house together and there's only so many people in that room at a time. Mm-hmm. So you can't really get the sense of scale that you expect, like, during the big early sequences with, like, the elephants and the parade and stuff. So, like, I love that Landis tries to create that scale by keeping cutting to the dog reaction shot. I don't think I've seen more dog reaction shots at the climax of like a non-animal based movie than I ever have at Coming to America. Like, the dog looks this way, the dog looks that way, the dog looks confused. It's like, it's as if Landa's saying, look, okay, I don't have a crowd here, I have a dog, but I can work with that. I can make the dog work for this movie.
Yes, and you know what? He did.
He did.
Also, you know,
He landed it
right in. It landed, unlike other things. That was dark.
Yeah, that was very dark. That twigged with me, and I was like, wow, he went there.
Ooh, you know what? Sometimes it just comes out, and that's live. I'm sorry. I probably would have cut that out if we had pre-recorded this, but I didn't. Moving, please, dear God, move on. You know who makes an appearance in Coming to America is my favorite WandaVision actor, David Langell, a.k.a. the mustache man from WandaVision.
Yeah, the Uber driver. I was like, I saw him, and I was like, that's Jack's favorite actor.
That's my favorite actor. I want to see him in everything. Put him in everything.
Because that answers my question about whether that was a prosthetic. Because I assumed, like, it's a luxuriant mustache.
Yeah.
I assumed it had to be a prosthetic, but it looks like, no, it comes with the actor.
No, that's just his bit. And, like, hopefully he can trade off of that mustache and face. It's a glorious mustache and face. I wish him nothing but the best. All right, let's move on to Rhea and the Last Dragon. Raya. Come on.
I'm not the one to correct anybody's pronunciation.
Let's move on to Raya and the Last Dragon. The newest Disney princess movie that is not really a Disney princess movie, but it kind of is.
It's very much a Disney princess movie. That's what really kind of like took me out. Because like, I mean, one of the things is you've had like the Disney Renaissance and you have like all the classic Disney princesses. And arguably that's what Disney's known for. I mean, like in Wreck-It Ralph, the big thing was, oh, we got all the princesses together, like an Avengers movie starring Pocahontas. Mm-hmm. And, like, one of the interesting things about watching Disney animation is that, you know, during the 90s, during the Renaissance, they were absolutely huge. They were fantastic. They were big. They were everywhere. Mm-hmm. Then you had like the emergence of like, you know, DreamWorks with Ants, and you had sort of like, you know, Pixar coming out with Toy Story. And it's like, are people really interested in princess movies anymore? So Disney kind of drifted away. They started doing like boys' own adventures, like say Tarzan, Atlantis, what was it, Treasure Planet and stuff like that. Didn't really work for the company. Brother Bear. I was reminded Brother Bear existed for the first time over the weekend. And I was like, I saw that movie. But like they went into the kind of wilderness, and then, you know, they tried to get into computer generated animation movies, like say Chicken Little, movies like Bolt, for example, movies like Meet the Robinsons, and that didn't work either. And I think what's really great is that, like, since about 2009, I think, with The Princess and the Frog, Disney have managed to make a pretty consistently great slate of princess-oriented movies. Mm-hmm. Movies like Princess and the Frog, movies like Tangled, movies like Frozen, Frozen 2, Moana, and obviously this one as well. And what really struck me watching Raya and the Last Dragon is, and we can maybe talk about this in a moment, the kind of like the lack of song and dance numbers, which is very strange because I'm so used to them being there. But outside of that, it is true, like, it is the most unabashedly princess movie. Like, during the introductory flashback, Raya is literally told, you are a princess of heart. Like, it's not, you're not a metaphorical princess. You're not like a warrior woman. Yeah. You're not like an adventurer. No, you are a princess. That is who you are, and that is your job. It's like, and then she gets like a quirky animal sidekick with Tuk Tuk the armadillo in the rich Disney tradition that includes generally horses, but like sassy companion animals and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. She ends up with kind of like a plucky comic relief sidekick, like Awkwafina channeling Joan Rivers, which is amazing. In the sort of like, it's fantastic. Like, again, in the tradition of like, you know, Sebastian from, you know, from Little Mermaid, of like Lumiere from like the Beauty and the Beast and stuff. Mm-hmm. And like, it is like unapologetically, formulaically, like a Disney princess movie is as pure a distillation of the concept as you will find. And it also does not make any apologies for it. And I kind of love that. It's not like, we're not going to deconstruct it. We're not going to blow it apart. Mm-hmm. She is a princess. Yeah. Like, we're going to call her a princess. We're going to say princess. It's not even like Moana, where she's a chieftain's daughter. And it's like, well, I guess she's kind of a princess, logically speaking, based on the hierarchical structure of the world in which they live. No. She is definitely 110% princess. And I love that. I love that aspect of it.
Yes. Well, and I, by being not a typical princess movie, there's no song numbers. There's no song numbers in this. Yes, she has a quirky animal friend. Her quirky animal friend is a furry armadillo that's also like a steampunk like unicycle. It's weird and it's beautiful. Like, I had a really good time watching this movie, is all I can tell you. It's weird. Like she doesn't do, she kung fu fights with an awesome grapple hook sword. Like, you know, it's not a princess movie, but also she saves the day with the power of friendship. And so it's like, what I'm saying here is we can have both, and I love it.
That's it, exactly. Like, it's not even like a lean-in princess movie. It's just a princess movie. It's fantastic. Like, again, and there's no love interest, although arguably, I think, like, a lot of fans would suggest that there is a love interest, if you catch my meaning. But, fans, like, nothing...
Fans need to go to horny jail. Just cool down for two fucking seconds.
Take a cold shower.
Just take a cold shower. She doesn't need one. I have seen on the internet who the love interest is. And it's like, fine. Yeah. Have all the theories you want. Also, this is a children's movie. Settle the F down.
Yeah, God, don't worry. We won't be talking about the weird Lola the Bunny and Pepe Le Pew discourse this week, I promise. You know that that's out there, and now it's in your mind. Sorry about that, Jack. It's in your mind.
All the fan art is back in my brain. Thanks, just like, boom, Darren.
Just materialized. Like, no, but you're entirely right, though, in terms of like the idea of, again, because again, it is a movie about solving these problems through love and friendship and belief and trust. Mm-hmm. And again, this is one of the things where, and it's really fucking weird to say this, but like, one of the big recurring themes in, like, you know, children's or family entertainment in recent years, and for very obvious reasons, has been the idea that, well, we are living in a world that is divided, falling apart, and people are no longer able to communicate with one another or trust one another, and the basic building blocks of our society have, like, fallen apart. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't know where that's coming from. I can't imagine so what would weird. Possibly inspire it's that. It's so just weird. Like, it's just weird that everybody just feels that all the same simultaneously. You have these movies then that are about, well, okay, well, look, we got to get back in harmony. We got to learn to trust each other. And again, you know, I think of examples like, say, Trolls World Tour, which is a big one as well, because it's, we're literally out of harmony because there are a bunch of trolls who play rock music. Also, we license these cool tracks and we hope you enjoy. But even things like we talked, I think, for like an absurd amount of time about Wonder Woman 1984. Mm. And like, again, my big issue with Wonder Woman 1984 is that it feels very much like your gran on like election day this year, just going, well, thank God all that's done and dusted. We can get back to the way things used to be. We'll just pretend those last 4 years didn't happen. Nobody meant anything. Yeah, that's it. It'll just be the way that it was. Everybody's going to get along. It's going to be fine.
No harm, no foul. No harm, no foul. That's exactly. Oh, wait, there was a lot of harm? Oh, there was? Oh, hold on.
Yeah, but still, they didn't mean any of it in their heart, right? And if they could see the truth of what they were doing, they'd all renounce their wishes. Oh. Am I right? Like, again, not to dump too much on Wonder Woman 1984, because we've already done that. But what I found fascinating about Raya and the Last Dragon is that Raya and the Last Dragon does that theme, which is everywhere now, and it makes sense that it's everywhere now, but it does it really well. It does it as well as I think I've seen it done.
Yes.
In that, like, again, it is a story about a mythical realm that is shattered into pieces mm-hmm. after a fundamental betrayal. And it's about how people don't trust each other and people constantly betray one another. And it's about a main character who, as you point out, her arc is through the power of heart and love, fixing the kingdom, which again is very similar to the arc of Trolls World Tour, the arc of Wonder Woman 1984. Mm-hmm. What I really loved about Raya and the Last Dragon, what I think it deserves a great deal of credit for, is that it actually took her lack of trust seriously. Mm. Raya's lack of trust in other people, it's very clear watching the movie that she's going to have to, at the climax, learn to trust somebody. She's going to have to take a leap of faith. It's very obvious from the outset. If you've ever watched a movie before, the movie hammers that theme home. Like, there's a point where she's sitting with Sisu the dragon, and she's like, the world's broken. Nobody trusts anybody. And Sisu says, maybe the world's broken because nobody trusts anybody. You're like, I know what you're doing here. Mm-hmm. But what I really admire about, like, the kind of, like, the Last Dragon is that, like, despite that setup, Raya is consistently proven right not to trust anybody. Mm. Like, for most of the movie's runtime, every time that Raya trusts somebody, every time that Sisu trusts somebody, it doesn't work out. The movie doesn't argue that, like, if you blindly believe that other people are good or decent, they will suddenly magically become good and decent and everything will work itself out. It actually argues that, no, it takes a lot of hard work and you have to be guarded sometimes mm-hmm. because if you're not guarded, you will be taken advantage of, and because other people won't act in good faith just because you are. But it somehow manages to do that while also earning an ending that is genuinely touching, because obviously at the end, Raya does have to take that leap of faith, and she does, and it pays off because it's the end of the movie. And I kind of liked it. I liked the way in which it really sold that idea. Yeah. Like, in a way that, like, again, I don't have kids. I'm kind of wondering, watching this with kids, you're like, is this a bit much? Did they go a bit far with the whole nobody can trust anybody? Did they safely reel that back?
No. Quite, like, you know, I was rather surprised. We watched this last night with the kids. And usually, like, I'll, you know, we'll watch, like, a movie and, you know, I'll ask them how they feel about it. Like, yeah, it was okay. Yeah, it was fine. Whatever. You know, like, after we watch, like, the Sonic the Hedgehog movie, yeah, that was fine. You know, very indifferent. But, like, this was one of the rare movies. We got done watching it last night. And I was like, so what'd you guys think? And both of them were like, they're getting a little older now, so they have to be cool. Yeah. But they're like, I'd be okay watching that again. I mean, if you wanted to or whatever, which, like, is super high praise for them. Like, because, like, yes, it's big, weighty themes. It is a movie, like Darren was saying, that shows its work. Like, yes, you know, it has the big sappy ending, but it walks you through all of the steps. It does the math. It has all of that. It has amazing action sequences. Yeah. And it has a very funny talking dragon.
And again, like, and it's so unapologetically as well, because like one of the things that I was worried about when I saw the trailers, I will admit, yeah, I was worried, because like, I mean, I like Awkwafina. I think Awkwafina does what she does really well. I think if you haven't seen The Farewell, she is phenomenal in The Farewell. She's really, really great there. But I was watching the trailer and I was like, this feels a little bit kind of, you know, hip and with the kids. Mm. And I was like, I'm not entirely sure I want a Disney movie that feels like it has to try so hard to be hip and with the kids. But then I watched it and it was like, no, this is pretty much perfect. This is to get back to like the movie we were talking about last. This is Eddie Murphy in Mulan kind of stuff. This is like precisely in the Disney wheelhouse. This isn't like, oh my God, look at how cool or hip we are. I think like there's maybe one reference to dabbing. That's about it. That was the only like cool contemporary reference. Oh, Captain Dubstep or something. He calls the kind of Buan the kind of
Captain Poppinlock. Because
Poppinlock.
Yeah, because he does that kind of dancing. Yeah. Right. Which is, yeah, like that's
like the one modern reference that I could like find watching it. Yeah.
Yes. No, and like it's very balanced. I know, like, just kind of gauging their reactions, the first, like, 10, 15 minutes where, you know, the who, what, where, the world building, the setup, the dark turn, like, they were a little on edge. Like, they were like, they could take it or leave it. But as soon as the dragon showed up, everything worked for them. And like for me, like, as a grown up watching it, like, this is the difference between a kids movie and a family movie. Is a family movie a grown-up could watch and enjoy. A kids movie, you gotta have kids if you're gonna like it. But the getting kind of back to these like sappy themes is also like the way they pace out the lessons learned. You know, they do something very similar to The Expanse, Darren and I's favorite sci-fi show, which is they start filling their ship with all the people from the different lands of this fractured world. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't get that at first. Like, I didn't get it until, like, the third or fourth person joined the ship. And I was like, wait a minute, they're doing something really clever. Like, it happens so naturally within the story. And like I said, I don't want to get into spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen it yet, but the way in which all of these antagonistical characters end up working together is so natural, and everyone, like it's a post-apocalyptic fantasy world, and so everyone has a sad backstory, and the way that they dole out everyone's sad backstory, I'm thinking specifically of the man from Spine. Is like, you know, the big man.
The Benedict Wong character, Tong, I think his name is.
Oh, okay. And you know, like, he never actually explains his backstory. They just show that wide shot of his land, and it starts sinking in why he's so mean and gruff. And, oh, it's just heartbreaking, and I love every minute of it.
But again, that's another one of the, we're not going to be particularly subtle with our themes. And again, I wonder if, like, setting this, the fact that, like, Ryan the Last Dragon has been talked about a lot, and understandably, to be fair, as, like, an Asian movie or a Southeast Asian movie, or in that context, kind of allows it a lot of leeway in the fact that it feels very much like it's a movie about contemporary America. But things like the emphasis that the movie places on, like, child and parent separation. Mm. Like, again, classic Disney trope. This is like Bambi. This is like The Lion King. But, like, throughout have this recurring motif of parents and children being separated from one another. And it's not consistently parents and it's not consistently children. But that's the two dynamics. It's never a husband and wife are separated. It's always a parent and a child, or a child from their parent. And again, you mentioned that, like, wonderful level of detail in the slow reveal. It's not just Tom. Like, even...
Right.
Like, people, when they watch the trailer, like, the Kung Fu baby gets a weepy backstory. Like, a proper, like, effective, like, I felt sorry for the Kung Fu Con baby. And it's like, you're a comedy character. I'm not meant to feel sorry for your plight, but I do.
The Kung Fu baby who steals things with a group of goofy monkeys has a heart-wrenching backstory, and it's natural and well done, people.
Like, again, like, it's remarkably well constructed. If I did have a minor complaint about Ryan the Last Dragon, again, this is the thing where I'm like, oh, people won't take me seriously if I don't make one small complaint. I did find that it had a similar problem to Moana for me, where like the structure was a bit episodic. It was a bit kind of fetch questy because, again, not in terms of like spoilers, Raya has to visit all of these kingdoms and collect something, basically.
Right.
She has to go each place. She has to pick up something to reunite and to bring the land together. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, some of it felt a little bit kind of like fetch quest. It's like, oh, now we're going to Talon. Now we're going to Spine. Now we're going to Fang.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, you kind of like, again, almost like playing a video game. It's like, bing, 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 bing. This is the level that we're doing now. I didn't think it was a problem, largely for the reason you mentioned. It's because the characters feel real and the action is like, the action's really good. Like, again, computer generated, like, again, done kind of kung fu style, done like, and again, they do split screen at certain points, which I adored. It's like, yeah, we actually took notes from like Hong Kong or East Asian cinema. It's like, yeah, this is how we convey action. And it's like, fine. You get away. I'm not going to complain about the lack of a musical number. This counts. This is your musical.
Like, and I guess I understand that criticism of fetch quest. It's like, okay, of basically ABC, like plot heavy, like, oh, this is the plot. Go here, go here, go here. Yeah. But also like, this is very high fantasy, a mystical land, strange creatures, a grapple hook sword people. I cannot explain how cool this is. And maybe this is just because like I'm super into Dungeons and Dragons right now. I'm running a few campaigns. I'm very into the mindset of like high fantasy episodic storytelling.
The sweet spot.
it's just the sweet spot for me at the moment. But everywhere we go, we get a new character that gets us more information, not only more information about the world, but that starts building the finale. Every character we meet, every place we go, starts building the finale That's together. Fair. And the way that they show all of their work, as far as like Raya's character arc, as far as anyone else's character arc is concerned, every place they go has a purpose. And that felt, maybe it's just like the movies we've been getting because theaters have been closing.
But yes, that's fair.
But that felt like something we don't get a lot. Like going back to Coming to America, there was no En Vogue musical number because we didn't need it.
That's the thing. Like, again, and the worth singling out like the score. Again, one of the things that I like about Raya is that we mentioned it's very funny. It has Aquafina in it. Of course it's funny. And like, I mean, even outside of that, it has like a number of really good jokes that work anyway. It has a con baby in it. Of course it's funny. And even like Benedict Wong's Tong, who is, as you mentioned, this big gruff dude who has this really tragic backstory, is kind of amazing as well. But like, it takes itself seriously. Like, the score is by James Newton Howard and it has these wonderful, beautiful, soaring kind of things. And it doesn't try to hide any of what it's doing in irony or self-awareness. Like, there are moments when, it's called The Last Dragon. So there are moments when you see dragons and it's like the movie like expects you to react with awe, majesty and wonder. And you do. There's no like ironic level of detachment. They're like, oh, look, it's a sassy dragon. It's like, no, it's a dragon and it's flying and the music is amazing. And I really admired that aspect of it, that level of kind of commitment, that unashamedness, like that sense of like, and again, this is the thing where we talk about like that period, like of 10, 12, 15 years where Disney was like, we don't really know who we're making these movies for. We kind of want boys to go see our movies too, so I guess they can have princesses in them. And you look at how far you've come from there to here. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously the fact that like Frozen 1 and Frozen 2 made all of the money helped a great deal in making Disney feel comfortable, as does we also own Star Wars and Marvel, so we don't have to worry about building something that appeals specifically to younger boys anymore. Obviously that helps build the confidence as well. Mm-hmm. But Raya just in general is so assured of itself. Mm-hmm. And I found that really infectious. Like, I mean, Kelly Marie Tran's performance, we haven't even touched on this, like, as Raya is really great. Like, again, she sells, like, she's given this stuff where she's allowed to be funny. Mm-hmm. She's allowed to be serious. She's allowed to have this big pathos, heartbreaking backstory. She gets to be Clint Eastwood, the man with no name. She gets to be Toshiro Mifune, the kind of nameless samurai, Sanjuro or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's, like, and that's amazing to me that it goes wholeheartedly. It never couches. It never kind of compromises. It's like, no, she's funny. but she's also got a sword that is a grapple hook. And like, that's what you need to get on board with.
And it all flows and it all fits. And I think a lot of that, and you know, maybe this can go even back to our Coming to America talk, is that idea that you just mentioned about how it doesn't try to be ironic with it. Yeah. Like, it doesn't try to hide the fact that this is what we're going for. We are proud of this. We are confident in the movie that we are giving you. And maybe that's the difference between John Landis directing Coming to America and
Greg Brewer
directing Coming to America, is that level of confidence in the material that you are presenting. And here with Raya, like, they could have very easily tried to like anti-cringe it by like making fun of the fact that the dragons of the past were a rainbow coalition of furry, adorable dragons that like, oh, they're not big, awesome dragons. They're floaty, magical, furry dragons. But you know what? They took it very seriously. And so as an audience member, that's the reality that you're watching, and you lock into that really, really quickly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like, it's worth pointing out, like, Coming to America does have that, like, ironic defense mechanism that we alluded to. There's literally a sequence in the movie where the characters talk about how terrible it is that they make sequels to old movies. Like, why would you want to ruin the old movie by making a bad sequel to it? And it's like, ugh. I can see you couching movie. I know what you're doing. I know you're setting it up so that if I say you're a bad sequel, you're like, ha, we called it. We meant to do it. We knew we were doing it. Joke's on you, critic. I get that you're doing that.
Yeah.
But like, there's no defensiveness here with Raya. It's very much like, no, this is what it is. Take it or leave it. Love it or hate it. Like, we're not going to pretend that we're too cool for school. We are what we are.
Yeah.
And I kind of admire that.
It's that kind of like heart on your sleeve filmmaking that we don't, you know, we're kind of in a post irony place in the world right now. And so that's also just a part of it is like, yes, our heroine of this movie has a tragic backstory. Yes, you know, she's a dragon nerd, but also is a badass loner wandering the wilderness of a post-apocalyptic fantasy realm. It's all of these things. And it doesn't...
Armadillo is a Mad Max unicycle.
I just think that's the coolest fucking thing.
It really is.
The giant armadillo that is also...
She sits on a rides it like a unicycle.
She rides an armadillo like a unicycle. And you never think to yourself like this is weird because it's so effing cool. Yes, also, thank you, Honey Money. Also, the armadillo is voiced by Alan Tudyk, who, Disney must just be like, just come and make some grunt noises. We love you, Alan. Just come on.
He's never going to say no to a check, right?
Oh,
they probably
like
have a little file of like Alan Tudyk noises. They can just kind of pop in.
Oh, they
like, Alan Tudyk plays a car. Yeah. Alan Tudyk plays an armadillo. Alan Tudyk plays a dog. It's like, just pop those in there.
But really, they're probably just friends and like, hey, come you. Hey, in this movie, we don't really have a part for you. Do you mind playing on furry armadillo? Oh yeah, that's fine. I can do that. Ah, great, Alan. We love having you around.
The part I was born to play, baby.
And so like. And she has two. Oh, you know what you said, Honey Money? You said Tuk-Tuk, not Tudyk, but Tuk-Tuk is Tudyk.
It's Tudyk, yeah.
Tuk-Tuk is Tudyk, and that's the important thing. And it's the thing I don't know like how much of this, because we had talked kind of about how we were very wary when they decided to move this movie to premium access. It's a $30 purchase on top of your Disney Plus subscription.
Yeah.
Which I can see hurting viewership of the movie. That being said, I also think it's worth it. It's a very, very good movie. It's like, this is the movie that the new Mulan was trying to be, you know?
Yeah, no, that's it. It's like, again, we talked about like one of the things about like the streaming era or like the era where we can't release movies in cinemas. The ones that tend to be getting released are generally dogs, you know. And again, there are exceptions to the rule, of course. There are good ones, but a lot of the ones that go straight to digital are movies like Trolls World Tour, where it's like, well, you know, you have kids, you're going to pay for it anyway. Or Scoob, it's like, look, it doesn't matter how insane and nonsensical this is, you're going to pay for it.
Yeah.
Mark Wahlberg playing like Blue Falcon, that's it. You're in. There's no comfort. It doesn't have to actually be good to fulfill its function.
Right.
I do think, yeah, right. You're right when you mentioned like maybe Ryan the Last Dragon feels so refreshing because we basically had a year at this point of those movies. And it's like a movie that has a basic narrative structure, a movie that isn't trying to be ironic or trying to couch itself or trying to preemptively fend off criticism. It does feel refreshing. And again, like this is like where, like, I'm sorry, I feel like the Martin Scorsese of like Disney animated movies. Like Raya feels like a real movie, but it feels like a movie I would pay to see in cinemas as opposed to waiting for streaming. Now, obviously, like $30 is an absurd amount, particularly as somebody who lives alone. 21 or 22 euro is an absurd amount for me to pay for this. Mm-hmm. And I freely admit that. And I, you know, it's up to you to determine if you want to pay for it. But I think if you have a family, it is like it's cheaper than a cinema trip would be.
Well, and you know, this is something I forget whether we've talked about this here or in other places where it's like, yeah, for me as a family of four, $30 is cheaper than going to the movies. And so like for me, it's great, except for the fact that it's not really $40. It's or $30. It's $30 plus $10 a month.
An ace.
Yeah. So, you know, however you want to break that down mathematically. And I get that. Like, if you are someone who just, you know, lives alone, like, yes, you're buying a movie before you know if it's any good, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which kind of sucks. That being said, I really think it's worth it. And I don't know if it is just... I don't know if it's just better than other things that have come out or if it's legitimately good. I will be rewatching this because I thought it was so flipping good.
Yeah. No, it's one of the best movies that I've seen so far this year. And I know we're only technically in March or whatever, but, you know, still. I mean, like, it's one of the best movies that I've seen since the pandemic started. Because obviously things like, say, Promising Young Woman I saw before the pandemic and released during the pandemic because they just couldn't hold on to them any longer because it was Oscar season. This is one of the first movies I've seen during the pandemic era that wasn't specifically designed for a streaming service, like, say, Palm Springs for Hulu or, like, say, His House on Netflix. Mm-hmm. This is one of the first cinema to streaming service releases that I've seen where I go, yeah, this is really good. I don't really have that many complaints. In fact, the complaint that I made, I freely admit, is just me being a bit of an arbitrary asshole just to get my critical cred up, because it's like, I can't say I love this unreservedly. I have to be cynical. I have to be ironic. You know, I'm not as comfortable with myself as Raya is, you know?
No, and like I see in the chat, you know, someone is saying, like, I hope it fails so that companies don't get used to doing this. I half agree with you. Like, it's weird right now, though, because obviously we're in a pandemic. Movie theaters aren't open. I'm putting out there that movie theaters shouldn't be open at the moment. That's my feelings on the subject. Obviously, other people feel different. So, like, for me, I want all movies to come to streaming right now. I also want them to go back to movie theaters when it is safe to go to movie theaters, as I personally am someone who loves movie theaters. I know many people hate movie theaters and wouldn't mind paying $30 a ticket if they get to watch it in the comfort of their own home.
No, like that's fair. I am, again, I'm somewhat more cynical than you are in that my belief is that if they do this model and it works, they're not going back to cinemas. My argument has always been, and I know this makes Darren the Grinch who stole Christmas, and I'm sorry, I am an asshole. My argument has always been, you know, like, when it is safe to reopen cinemas. Mm-hmm. So not in the middle of a gigantic pandemic, when and where it is safe to open cinemas, movies should go there. Mm-hmm. And like, we should hold them back. I don't mind that I haven't seen the new James Bond movie. I don't mind that I haven't seen the new Fast and Furious movie. I think there are enough good movies I haven't seen that I've been able to dig through the back catalog and keep myself entertained, mm-hmm. you know, through this pandemic. So I don't mind that too much. I don't mind that Black Widow isn't out yet. I don't mind that as long as once that happens, once cinemas are open and it's safe, they get to go out there and I can go and see them in a cinema. That said, yeah, I mean, again, I do wonder, I sit down and I watch this. I'm in the middle of, and again, sorry, this is a completely unrelated tangent. I'm in the middle of a film festival here in Dublin. It's the Dublin International Film Festival, and it's all being held from home because obviously we had a surge in numbers at Christmas that we are trying to get down. So everything is shut down. And so I am now attending the Dublin Film Festival in my own sitting room, which in theory is good because it means I can watch more movies. I don't have to worry about shimmying around to cinemas. I don't have to worry about arriving late or having to sit in an awkward seat or getting crammed into a corner or sitting next to somebody who's like munching on something very loudly or whatever.
Yeah.
But it also, like, I just miss the experience. There are movies that I've watched here, like The Boys from County Hell, which is an Irish vampire movie. And it's a solid vampire movie. But I watched it and it was like, you know, again, it's a midnight movie. And I was like, this would kill if I was watching it in an audience of people at like 11 o'clock at night. You know, people who had, you know, maybe some beer or some wine or whatever. Mm-hmm. And were very much in the mood for like an Irish vampire green room movie. And it would be amazing. And I would love that experience to death. And I'm sitting down watching it at home and thinking, this is a solidly well-made film. And it's like, it's good. I'm enjoying this. But it's like, I miss that aspect of kind of community of it, you know, to be fair. And again, I know that's very privileged. And I know that's very like, you know, not everybody has access to the same sort of art house cinemas. Not everybody can afford to go. Mobility isn't easy, you know. And again, vaccines are going to be rolled out very slowly. So not everybody's going to have access simultaneously. And I acknowledge that. And I know that there's no easy way around it. And I know that you certainly shouldn't be coming to a podcast about movies for pandemic advice or commentary. But I do actually miss that experience of being in cinemas and being around people and kind of like just watching a movie with a crowd that is into it. Like The Raid. Have you seen The Raid?
Of course I've seen The Raid. Love The Raid.
Did you see The Raid with a crowd?
I did not, but I would have loved to see it with a crowd.
It's one of my favorite cinema experiences. 11 a.m. in the morning in the middle of the festival, bleary-eyed because I've been doing 10 days beforehand. Yeah, it's I stumble into the cinema at 11 o'clock in the morning and bam! It's just like, and the roof rises. I think like the people who own the cinema have said they've never had a screening like that. And it's like, yeah, like that's, and I know that's not every cinema experience, but that's kind of what I miss. And yeah, so I'm sorry, that's a very roundabout way of Darren saying I like cinemas.
No, and I like, there's nothing, I don't think there's anything wrong in saying that, like, I cannot wait to go back to those kind of communal experiences when it's safe, obviously. There is something really special about the theater going experience. I've seen it compared, or I've seen like neuroscientists kind of discuss what happens in our brains. For example, when you hear someone laugh, your brain readies that part of your brain, the humor part of your brain, because humans are naturally empathetic. And so if you hear someone laugh, it actually prepares you to laugh before you even hear anything funny. And it's that kind of communal experience in the theaters. Like, you hear people laugh. Oh, I hear people laugh. I'm now more primed to laugh. I hear people gasp. I am now more primed to gasp. I see people afraid. I am more primed to be afraid because we're naturally empathetic like that. And so we can watch all the movies we want alone on my nice computer monitor. It's a HDR computer monitor. The picture looks great. It won't be the same experience. Like, I was watching Coming to America very, you know, clinically going, meh.
But it triggered all the nostalgia beats, right? It's just like, yeah, no, exactly. This is just for me. This is just for me.
But watching Raya and the Last Dragon last night, even just with my family, like hearing my kids bust a gut at the little stealing baby, like, it gets you into that flow so much better. Absolutely.
Yeah, sorry. So yeah, I mean, again, whether or not this is worth $30 to you is for you to determine.
Right.
I saw it as a preview screen. I didn't pay for it. And I feel like, you know, that's worth acknowledging and playing out there. I didn't pay $30 to see it. So maybe if I had paid $30 to see it, my gripe would be a lot more serious.
Also, like, you know, we're getting close to wrap up time here. And I do I do want to mention specifically, like, how good the animation is. Like, there were specific shots during a fight sequence where we get like a close-up of, oh, I'm trying to think of the main villain girl, the Fang villain.
The one played by Gemma Chan, that's Namari.
Namari, like, we get a close-up of Namari's arm and you can see individual white hairs on her arm. And it's like the detail that we now get in 3D animated movies is mind-blowing. It's just a gorgeous looking movie.
Yeah, and again, there's lots of points where you see fabric and you can see the threading on the fabric. Yes. And again, this is one of the things where, you know, I should know more about movie making than I actually do, but I'm like, did somebody have to go in and like individually program each of those little hairs? Or do they have an algorithm that kind of designed in order to evenly distribute them so they look random, but it's gorgeous?
They probably have an algorithm, but then someone needs to curate the algorithm to make sure it looks just right. And like, if one hair's out, they have to manually animate that. That's so, it's so gorgeous. And like the atmosphere, like they've really nailed like that natural atmosphere in digital cameras now, where it's like the little dust flecks. You know, it's not like, it's not like the J.J. Abrams lens flare that's just like in the mid, in like right in front. It's just like tiny little dust flecks that it's that natural atmosphere that they have in their cameras now. And of course, you know, it's Disney stylized, so everyone has giant eyes, even not babies, and that's fine. That's just Disney style. But, you know,
it's also good because it means that the CGI doesn't go into the uncanny valley. I mean, like, yes. You know, as impressive as like Final Fantasy, The Ghost Within, or, you know, is, it's still, you watch it and you're like, there's something wrong. There's something very wrong.
Yes, exactly. And so it's still stylized, but the technical achievements in animation is gorgeous. That, like, I can't say enough about how cool the action is, the fantasy of it all, the sword, the ride in the giant.
It has
armadillo.
A grapple. It has a sword grapple.
It's
don't forget the sword grapple.
What's the fighting game? It's Ivy from Soul Calibur. Remember Ivy from Soul Calibur? She has that sword that turns into like a chain whip. That's the sword she has. It's awesome. It's awesome.
I love that was the moment that Jack was fully on board. It's like, well, like, you know, I'm not sure I can entirely relate to this story of a society divided and, you know, a young woman working through her trust issues, but she has a grapple sword. It's like, I'm in.
Yes. What's wrong with that?
That's all you had to say.
Like, I, you know, like, we get that sword very early in the movie, but then she's like using it as a utility weapon. And all I'm thinking to myself is, I'm just thinking to like my Dungeons and Dragons campaign, where if a player asked if they could do that with that sword, I would think it was genius. And so I'm thinking it's genius that they did that with the sword. And I'm so on board. I'm so on board with the sword.
Thank you. That's a very sharp exit line.
Boom!
That's what I like about you, Jack. You always get to the point. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's exactly how we end the podcast. Spirits Within came out in 2001. Is that true?
To make us all feel old. Yeah, that seems about right, because I do remember being after the initial wave of Pixar ones.
Ooh,
again, man. Like, the thing with Pixar is Pixar animated toys first, because did you see the baby short? Have you seen their short with... Yeah. So they were like, you know, maybe just stick with plastic things first. And again, like, I feel like that's a good idea. I feel like, you know, again, completely CGI people, little uncomfortable, little creepy, little rubbery, little like pod people. But I feel like Disney, CGI Disney people, I'm like, okay, I can, that works for me.
Right. Make them a style. Even like, you know, like later when Brad Bird was like, did The Incredibles. Like they were style. Yes.
Yeah.
And that's okay. That's how we should do it. So there you have it. We have something old, something new, something borrowed, and something that blew my mind.
Nice. I appreciate that.
Would
you say the movie was a real Ray of Sunshine? Huh?
Ooh, it certainly wasn't Dragon for my attention. No, I'm not as good as you. That's fine.
No worries. All right. Is that your last one?
Died.
I only have so many words left in the title. It's either that or and. I can't work it in and. And doesn't really work as a pun. I guess I could keep it Andy.
Well, don't worry, everyone. The two of us will be back next week for more Escapist Movie Podcast. Thank you so much for coming and watching watching and listening to this later. Once again, I've been Jack Packard.
I've been Darren Mooney.
And I am going to go to credits now. Boom.